In 1979, Sugar Babies, the burlesque musical, had its world premiere in Philadelphia. After 3 very successful years on Broadway, it has returned to Philadelphia's Schubert Theater with its original stars, Mickey Rooney and Ann Miller, and a cast of vaudeville and burlesque alumni, as well as chorus girls, fan dancers, and a juggler and ventriloquist. Nels Nelson of the Daily News and William B. Collins of the Enquirer wrote rave reviews for today's papers. With me are the two producers of Sugar Babies, Harry Rigby and Terry Kramer. The show was conceived by Harry Rigby and theater scholar Ralph Allen. Rigby is credited with creating the trend of successful revivals when he conceived and produced the revival of No No Nanette. Some of his other hits include Half a Sixpence, I Love My Wife, Hallelujah Baby, and Irene. Harry Rigby is from Philadelphia and now lives in New York. Terry Kramer co-produced I Love My Wife, Knock Knock, A Meeting by the River, and Gory Stories with Harry Rigby. Her mother was also a Broadway producer. Sugar Babies just began a 4-week run at the Schubert Theater in Philadelphia. Terry Kramer, Harry Rigby, welcome to Fresh Air. Welcome back to Philadelphia's stage. Harry Rigby, would you tell us about the creation of Sugar Babies?
Well, it all began when I went to a lecture Ralph Allen gave at Lincoln Center. It was one of those, you know, very pedantic conferences of the arts where they dealt with Toby shows, just everything, and his core subject was burlesque. And it was a very egghead audience. He's like, oh, deadheads, nothing's going to happen with this group. And they were on the floor. So I asked him to come over to Terry's house right after the lecture. We did. And so we all got together and decided we would do Sugar Babies. It wasn't called Sugar Babies then. It was just called a burlesque show. We got the title later. You remember that afternoon?
I do. It was very funny.
What made you think it was going to work on Broadway?
I usually believe Harry when he tells me something.
Sometimes. Good. I want a recording of this program. I can use that sometime.
What made you think it was going to work on Broadway?
Because the jokes. People want to laugh. And, what we did with Terry and I did was this highly romanticized. Our image was, I think you have to have an image every time you do a show. You at least try to have one. And we thought of it as that big burlesque show up in the sky. Because, there never was a burlesque show like this. But
I think we wanted people to have a good time. We were awfully tired of being lectured at in the theater. And we thought it was fun and everybody would enjoy it.
Yeah, the opposite of a Hal Prince show.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean...
songs you can sing, pretty girls, right?
Yeah.
And jokes that you can understand. Anybody can understand them.
Well, just having jokes.
That's right. No tragedy.
Makes it different.
What did you know that you would need in order to attract audiences and be successful on Broadway? Need in the way of stars and orchestration and glamour or costumes?
Well, we always had Mickey and Ann in mind. I mean, from the word go. And it was to prevail upon them to do it. You know, actors never do what's best for them. I mean, they have to be pushed into it. Dragged and screamy, wouldn't you say, Terry?
No, I would say very much so.
And Mickey came along, said yes before Ann did. Ann waited to the very, very last second. She waits for everything.
The story of Ann's life in the show.
No, she is the past mistress of brinkmanship. She is superb at that, among other things. Tapping and brinkmanship.
Do you have any personal connection to burlesque?
No, I really don't.
do you?
No. I saw it, but I mean,
we're not that old yet.
Well, I'm that old, but no.
Not even.
You mean I appear in burlesque as a second banana or something? No. I didn't
and
even sell candy at intermission,
How has the show changed since it first opened in Philadelphia?
I think it's better. If I'm like a parent with a child growing up, I think the show is fabulous now. I thought it was great before. I think it looks better. These girls dance. I just think it's so much better.
They're prettier,
and much prettier. And I thought they were beautiful to start with, so they're even prettier. But it's more precise. It's brighter. The jokes are as funny or funnier, which is very interesting because you never get tired listening to those same jokes. I think it's a better show.
Well, the cast, I think it's a better show than the one that closed in New York, really, because we combined one part, and the second bananas are much better than, I think, the cast we had in New York that closed. And I hope none of the people that were in the show that closed in New York and are not with us now are hearing this. But anyway, the present cast is better.
When people come to Sugar Babies, they usually bring, I think, their own shtick with them. You know, if they're
you
known
mean the actors,
yeah, if they're known for something from the stage, yeah. Or and of course the Michael Davis, the juggler that many people know from Saturday Night Live or the DeCavett Show, brings his act with him. He doesn't fit himself in somebody else's.
No.
How have you gone looking for these new people? Do you participate in that process as the producers?
Yeah,
of course.
Yes.
That's our job.
I mean, that's... Michael was in another show, and we went to see the show. But it was in previews, and we said, we got to get him.
Actually,
and we knew
funny.
The show was going to bomb.
It closed on opening night, and I was far away. I was making these phone calls to Harry. Quick, get over there and sign
and
him
so,
up.
But we were being very, very tactful and diplomatic, and we didn't call him before I make the offer. So we called, you know, when we were told the show closed. So we called up Michael, and he said, well, he'd love to be in Sugar Babies, but he was in another show. And we had the terrible duty of telling him he wasn't in another show anymore, that they put out the notice and nobody had told him. But it was so he came in the show the following week. And from that, you know, he got Saturday Night Live. He appeared in that a lot. And all those things can happen for him now. I think he should get a series because he is not just a juggler. I think he's a comic actor, a brilliant one.
Musicals have become extraordinarily expensive. Where does the bulk of that cost come from?
The bulk of the cost to bring it to the stage?
Yeah, to produce a show.
Well, whatever, and you just look at inflation. I mean, the sets cost four or five times as much as they used to cost. The costumes have gone up. We don't even talk about salaries because you're talking about a physical production. Copying, whatever. It just, whatever cost. We did a show once here. It was a much smaller show, but we did a musical for $485,000. We can't do a straight play for that today. A two-character play we'd have trouble doing.
What does it cost to put Sugar Babies on Broadway?
It originally cost $1.3 million.
How do you raise that much money?
You go to people
Terry
that love
does.
The theater.
She's wonderful. I'm terrible at it, but she is terrific.
You know, first of all, you have to know your people. You have to know your show. I could not raise money for, let's say, a Hal Prince show because the people I know like the theater for the joy that it brings to them. They're working people. They're creative people. They want to go to the theater and really have a good time. And so I couldn't tackle a project like that because it doesn't go with me. I can do these kind of shows with Harry because I know he knows, as they said about him in the Philadelphia paper, he is a genius.
Oh, wow.
And he does smell a trend of what the public wants at that particular moment. It might be sometimes 5 years till he can get the show on, and that trend is past. But he knows what they want as far as entertainment goes. So the truth of the matter with this show was I said to him, burlesque? What's burlesque? I don't want to do burlesque. I don't know anything about burlesque. But he said, this is what they want to hear, believe me. And he was right.
Well, you
and
said
I
yes,
came
right
around.
Away.
But I was reluctant because I thought, oh, what's he talking about, situation comedies, which is really...
You got reluctant later on, but you didn't instantly. And then you came back.
That's why we're such a good team.
So do you hold lunches for people? And
no, what we
them?
Do is... I know where I can get the money, and we usually have what they call an audition, a backers audition, at my apartment. Once we had one in a restaurant, and we don't have just people off of the street. I mean, you just can't bring my aunt is in from Chicago. Can she listen to the score? No, because I don't want to go with the 500 investors if I don't have to. So we pretty well know that there are going to be 20 people that are coming that if they like it, they can invest. And then we have some industrial investment. This show we had Columbia Pictures. They took 20% of the show. And unfortunately, that's what you have to do in the theater nowadays. As a business person, I want to tell you that small investor is hard to get now. And it's going that way where the studios, the networks, the big money people are going to be the backers of shows.
Is Broadway considered a good investment?
No, but it never was. You're not supposed to invest in Broadway to make money. You're supposed to invest in Broadway because you love the theater.
And you can afford,
you know, and you have fun with it.
And when you
and
have
you
a
can
hit.
Get an Annie or a Sugar Babies, you know. All you need is one hit. If you have 10 losses, one hit makes up for it.
Mm-hmm. I never would suggest that anybody put it in unless they could afford to, or they just, you know, wanted it for the fun of it. It can pay off very well, which it has, but...
It's not for your life savings.
I wouldn't suggest it if somebody were going to sit back and say, well, I shall put such and such money, my life savings, into a show. Never. I wouldn't take their life savings, would you?
No, never.
I mean...
It's for the sophisticated, as they say in Wall Street, the sophisticated investor. But it's a different kind of investor, I think.
It's I think they do it, most of them. Well, not Columbia Pictures, but most of them, our investors do it. I think instead of going to a racetrack, I mean, or something else, that is what they indulge themselves with.
And they love it, and they write us letters, and they tell us what numbers we should change. And
yeah, and I never pay any attention to that.
But I mean... They give us a lot of advice.
Terry Kramer and Harry Rigby are my guests, the co-producers of Sugar Babies, the burlesque musical, which just reopened in Philadelphia at the Schubert Theater for a 4-week run. How would you describe what it is a producer does?
Everything.
Oh.
Harry is more than the normal producer because he is also the creative part of the team. I just have a little creative input. But
well, that isn't so.
If he were not a producer, he would be a writer.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Or either. Conceiving projects or something. But a producer has to do everything. You can start out as
I once even had to paint the scenery because the set designer walked out. This was off Broadway. And I did a lousy job, I remember, in Walter. It was, It was Electra. And Walter Kerr said that the Greek temple looked like a garage.
And so. I had to chop off Ann Miller's courtroom scene dress, remember?
Yes.
To make it sexier, and so I just showed them what to do that. They're all things we have to do. Sometimes remember with I Love My Wife? And I had to go to that sleazy district here, and in Broadway, to buy the sexy underwear.
Oh, yeah, like Fredericks of Hollywood.
You had to buy the bras and the
garter
belts.
They have a place like that in Philadelphia?
Yes, Harry, right down the street from where the theater was.
That any Philadelphia lady would wear those undergarments.
Well, the actress was in Philadelphia, obviously. But we have to do all kinds of things. And then we have to, I think everybody forgets that a producer, or we're a team, producing team, it doesn't stop after opening night. It's like a child, really.
It's endless.
It's an ongoing project. You get from this stop to that growth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You have to see that the show is kept fresh. I mean, everybody always is agog when Harry and I said, we have to go, I'm going to go to the theater for a few minutes. Well, why? The show's been running for 3 years. We want to make sure what's happening.
When you became a producer, Harry Rigby, did anyone try to warn you away from it and tell you nightmarish stories about what could happen if you got into that field?
Oh, I'm sure we both were warned. You know, John Murray Anderson, whom I worked with, was a very famous director, called the theater a sewer, and he delighted in telling people not to be in the theater. But, you know, if somebody wants to be in the theater, you could say it's a sewer. You could say it isn't a sewer, by the way. But you could say anything to deter them, and it wouldn't. It just wouldn't. I think it's a virus, really, because nobody in their right mind would go through some of the things we get.
Do you know we get phone calls at 4 in the morning?
From who?
Ann Miller has no sense of time. And what I do is I just usually, if I think she's going to call, I just take the phone off the hook and let her be frustrated. Because, you know, she watches television or something all night long. Or reads Rosemary Rogers or something, you know? And she has no compunction about calling at that time, does she?
None. Well, when we were in Detroit, it was funny. I lived with two of the chorus girls on the road. And Detroit's, I hope nobody from Detroit's listening, is a horrendous place and very scary for girls. And you can't eat unless you eat at a certain time. And you can't go out at night.
Well, there's no place to go.
Oh, it was just awful. And so we used to crawl back into this hotel room and we'd... have a bottle of wine and cheese and sit around and gab and finally get to sleep at like 2 in the morning and the phone would ring and it'd be Annie because she had no place to go either and she was on a movie that she had made, you know, Girl Crazy, whatever, and she'd call you up and you'd have to watch that movie and she wouldn't get off the phone and she had to hear the volume and that you were watching her dancing and singing. So, but it's we just have crazy
Mickey
things.
Mickey doesn't do that.
No.
Mickey
reads you the new script that he wrote.
He calls you like 7 o'clock in the morning because, you know, you've seen him on stage, so you know that energy is just awe-inspiring. So he gets bored. And so at 7 in the morning, if there aren't any races and he doesn't
or
have
golf
the
courses.
Form to try to figure out, or play golf, I mean, he calls you up at 7 in the morning. So it's like Anne at 4 and Mickey at 7. Now, you try that sometime.
Terry Kramer, your mother was a Broadway producer. Mm-hmm. Did she ever encourage you or discourage you from entering?
Well, my mother had died before I actually did enter the theater. My mother, Harry, is much younger, but I met Harry actually through my mother with Truman Capote.
Yeah, I met when you were 19.
Who reduced me to tears, and I was 17, thank you very much.
17, okay.
And a freshman at Vassar, and they did a show together. That's how I met Harry originally. But she died before I went into theater. I wanted to be a movie star. And I was discovered around the Beverly Hills swimming pool when I was with my mother, when I was 17 also. And my mother and father did not believe that girls should do those things in those days.
Might be an actress?
Right. One should have an education, be professional, or get married and have children. And so they schemed to actually purchase this movie studio, which wasn't a very good one, so that I could not have a screen test, which I did not have. So I am now paying them back. That's how I got into the theater. I got into the theater when my children were really in their teens, and both my husband and father thought I was going to get a little restless because I like to do things. And they thought it would be a natural kind of a job for me because I could be home cooking and cleaning all day. And the theater is a nighttime job, and I get something to do at night. And that's how it worked out in the beginning.
What kind of director do you like to work with?
Oh, there's so many different kind of directors.
I would like the ideal director would be...
One has a nice disposition.
Right, brilliant.
Brilliant, but with a nice disposition.
And I would listen to us when we have suggestions, because I think both of us have feelings about it. After all, we find the properties. There must be some reason we chose those properties.
When your phone rings in the middle of the night, is it ever someone who's got something that they've written that they know is exactly what you're going to want to produce?
Well, they wouldn't dare
not
call you in
drunk.
The middle of the night with
that's
that,
true,
Terry.
Isn't it?
I mean.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Not very success-oriented, is it, to do that?
Well, I wouldn't think.
But what are some of the ploys people use to get your attention?
Well, nothing very unusual.
No, I tell you truthfully, Harry and I had an unfortunate string of two shows did not live up to our expectations. And they were within 3 months of each other. And our telephones never rang.
Oh, no, if you have a flop.
They didn't realize
that
we were out of business.
You can have 10 hits before that. You have one flop and...
Agents send you the worst properties
in the
world.
You go into a restaurant and nobody says hello anymore.
Now, you know,
they're
sending everything to us. And
yeah, but, you know, a week from now, they wouldn't be.
No, I know.
Sometimes it sounds that theater and show business is really the most two-faced industry around.
Every business is. I was raised in the banking business. I don't think it's any different, except I will say that in the business other than the arts, people do go by their word a lot more.
Uh-huh.
I find the theater a little different. It's handshakes are not the same. You know, you have to have contracts and everything has to be spelled out.
Well, do you ever feel that way about other people, that if they have a flop, you don't want to see them?
Oh, no. Because you say, one has to say it's going to happen. You know, it's impossible to have nothing but one hit after another. I know no one who ever has, you know. And maybe if it did, it would be very monotonous, I mean, wouldn't it?
Maybe trivia. We could try it for 5 years.
I had a director. We had a director on a play recently who bowed out of it because he had done about four shows, and they all got wonderful notices. And he did one show, this last one, and he got killed for it. Well, he went completely to pieces. And that's happened to several people I know. And they can't take failure, but you have to. You just have to, particularly, you know, in the theater. I guess in movies you have sort of insurance about it because we know people that have done like six terrible movies in a row, and they say, well, he knows how to make movies.
They just rotate
so he
movies.
Gets another one. I never figured that one out, but that's what happens in
Hollywood. I think it's just a different financial scale, so they can just go from in one door and out the next.
Yeah, what I've heard that in films, a failed screenwriter or a failed director has at least had practice, and they'll be hired sooner than someone with no track record.
And it depends on how big the picture was. The bigger the picture, even though it lost the money, the more...
The bigger the job they're going to get the next
admirable
time.
Admirable, they consider, or rather horrible, or whatever it is. The bankable, is that the word? The producer. I'm thinking of
bankable.
A friend of yours in particular, my dear.
Harry Rigby, you're credited with helping to start a trend in revivals through the production of No, No, Nanette that you produced and conceived. Why did you think that the time was right to revive a show from, was it the teens or the 20s that was from?
Oh, that was a 20s show. The way we produce this, it would be something that we'd want to see, and I wanted to see that show. And I think that's the only way you could really honestly do something. You have to want to see it yourself. And then hopefully other people agree with you. But we do try to do a show for an audience. I think a lot of people do a show for themselves, you know, and we don't. We make a conscious effort not to do that. And we listen to the audience, and they're the ones that really tell us.
Revivals have become...
And, of course, Bill Collins, but...
Revivals have become a trend, and to some people this is a great indication of health because it means that great theater becomes recyclable and you have like an American repertory, and if you weren't alive or going to the theater when something was produced, you could still see it. But other people say it's a sign that theater is sick because there isn't enough contemporary stuff to fill the stages. We have to go back and choose things from the past.
Well,
do you think that the revivals indicate anything?
I mean,
I don't think theater is sick. I think theater is... I think a lot of the critics are sick. And I don't think... I think the public should come... Somehow or other, they should be taught in kindergarten that they're allowed to think for themselves. And you don't always need a stamp of approval on a property. And that's why I think it's very hard to see new projects unless you see them off-Broadway, and off-Broadway is really the place now for new projects. I think Harry and I would think seriously from now on to go to workshop first.
Well, it depends on the show. I mean, you wouldn't go to a workshop with Sugar Baby.
No, I don't mean a major musical, but I mean...
Yeah, I know. It's something more, let's say, esoteric or whatever. But about, you see, if you don't see a show like No, No, Nanette or... I always think, one thing I want to make clear, that I don't think you should do yesterday, revive yesterday. I always say the day before yesterday, when it's far back enough that really most people haven't seen it, because then it truly is a new experience. But how often do you see a show where there are about 6 hit tunes in it, or 5, 4? Or, you know, you see them once in a while with one, like Cats has that song that you just hear and hear and hear. Or, for instance, Little Night Music, The Clowns.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Sending the Clowns.
Now, they're just, those two songs right now are just as ubiquitous as Stardust used to be. But, I mean, like, I Want to Be Happy and Too Many Rings Around Rosie and all the songs from Nanette. They were sort of a revelation to people. And shows used to, they had to have a tuneful score. Like the gentleman on the Daily News today said in the... that he went in humming the score, humming the tunes, which I thought was a marvelous way to think. And you do that with the old shows. You can't do it with the new shows. Who's going to come in humming A Doll's Life?
They didn't go out humming it either, which is even worse.
Have you ever had any disasters?
I had a disaster which broke my heart and almost took me out of the theater.
What?
Frankenstein.
Well, that could
which
have been
is,
a hit.
Was, I thought, the best show I ever did in my life. And Harry wasn't my partner, and I had some bad partners at the time. But I think it was pathetic, because that show was, as we say, we listened to the audience. I've never been connected with anything that for 4 weeks sold out every day without a review. Nobody ever left the theater, young people and old people, and they had a marvelous time. It was just an unfortunate thing. And the critics thought we should have been doing Freud or something.
If you had a TV commercial for that, which
I think they just took it seriously and they didn't take it as a tongue-in-cheek thing, and it was fun. So that was my disaster. Harry hasn't had any terrible disasters.
Oh, yes, I have. And I put them out of my mind, and I'm not going to talk about them, okay?
And that's good. He's right.
So you think that theater critics... affect the life of theater more than, say, film critics affect
the
theater.
Yes. Oh, film yes. critics have nothing to do with the show at all, with the movie. You know,
it's like,
well, only in big cities. Statistically wise, it's only New York and Chicago and L.A. that, you know, it has nothing to do with the rest of the country.
Uh-huh.
I think theater critics are, well, I don't know about, I think New York, I think the New York Times makes or breaks a show.
And that was so wonderful. We found out Walter Kerr liked our show before the opening night, because what they do is, they go to previews now, critics. An opening night is just really now for TV critics, and that's in New York, or your radio critics. But like Rich of the Times, they go to a matinee and everything, and then they have lots of time to think and write their review. Sometimes I wonder if we should give them all that time to think and write their review. But anyway, that's how they do it. So Mr. Kerr came to a matinee. And we didn't know what he thought. They keep everything very secret. There's no way you can find out. But the day of the opening, the Times called up and said, could they assign a reporter to follow Mickey Rooney from the time he came in the theater that night to the party and everything? And we said, oh, my God, Walter Kerr must like us, because they couldn't be so cruel to have somebody assign somebody to something that they didn't like. And, of course, they did like it, but we really felt that way. So that night wasn't the torture that most opening nights are.
That was the best opening night we've ever had, I
think. Yeah, bless Walter Kerr.
Do you have any superstitious rituals you go through on an opening night?
I always wear a black, long black dress. I don't know why, but I always do.
I always go out and get drunk and, you know, intermission.
Listen, I'll tell you what Harry really does. Bill Collins, listen. He polishes his floors and cleans his apartment, remember?
Oh, yeah, it's exercise.
That's what he does on opening night day.
Why?
Well, it just keeps you occupied. You know, because you're so nervous. It's much better than, you know, biting all your fingernails and all the other, you know, nervous manifestations.
And my husband's back always goes out, right?
Yes.
Every opening night, without fail.
What do you do for your own stress, since I'm sure you have a lot of it, particularly around opening night?
Not the Ovaltine, huh?
Do you go to the theater much to see what everybody else is doing?
Yes.
Or just for your own amusement?
We go for our own amusement.
Well, you go more than I do.
Well, I don't know. I have a father that just loves Off-Broadway and young writers and all. And
he's the one that tells us.
He calls us up and says, you must go right away or something. But we do go to a lot of things.
Well, you do when, you know, the Tony time comes and you're supposed to vote. And if you're going to be tall, honest about the voting, you really have to see the shows. So we really make a conscious effort to do that. And that's when I go. It's a very concerted thing. I've often wondered, like, when I go to London, I go to a show every day, and sometimes twice, because, you know, they stagger times over there. I've seen three shows a day there. And I said, why am I doing this here when I wouldn't do it in New York? I remember
because we've got to pay for a hotel room over there, so we have to get it done quickly.
Years ago, Tallulah Bankhead told me that she never went to the theater. And I was just shocked and appalled. And I said, how could not even to see your friend, the Lancer, Ethelbert? No, I never go. And now I can understand that, because you're so immersed in it and all the time that it's almost redundant, maybe. But, you know, but then I was shocked by her statement, that statement.
You've tried to, I think, lure some people out of retirement who you've wanted to to use. How do you go about getting someone who you want?
Well, what do? We get on our knees and sing Mammy. No, it's, for instance, in Ruby Keeler's case, Ruby's husband had died, and she had a marvelous marriage. But her children were all grown up, and she was bored. And she would kept up her tapping, you know. She'd tap on the back porch, she said. And I asked her, and she said no. And then I think her children said, oh, Mom, they did. You have to do this. So I got Busby Berkeley to call her up. He said, call her back right away, because she said she'd do it. And I called her and she said yes. And, you know, I thought it was because she was worried about her part and maybe she wanted an extra number, and I was prepared to go out about that again. No, it wasn't that. It's just she was, you know, really frightened. People are frightened of Broadway because it is the final test. Of course, Ruby came from Broadway. But in the case of Debbie Reynolds, I mean, she really is putting her head on the block because if you don't do well, it's really bad for your career. But it also is the biggest booster for a career imaginable, isn't it?
Well, look what it did to Mickey.
For Mickey, yeah. And Annie Miller.
I mean, it's an unbelievable thing. What can happen when you click on Broadway?
Well, it gives you a prestige you can get no other way. It's so.
Of course, it's far from Los Angeles where people are doing films, so I guess that creates some conflicts because you don't know how long something's going to run. What would you do if someone who you had gotten to be in a show wanted to leave it to do a film?
Well, you have a contract before you start, and most of the contracts have a standard 6 weeks out. For a major motion picture, it's quite...
For a certain amount of time.
Yeah, it's 6 weeks, usually at the most, and it's quite... it's spelled out very clearly.
Or they can shoot it in New York, which they shoot a lot of pictures now.
They did
Mickey's
that for
done a couple of those TV movies in New York.
And we just made him come
while
to the
we
city.
Were doing the, while he was doing the show. But, I mean, he, of course, as I told you before, is you know, energy.
If you had a Dudley Moore or something in a show, I'm sure the contract would read, I will only work for 3 months or 6 months.
Do you have crazy kinds of insurance when you start a show?
We do. Star insurance. Mm-hmm.
What's star insurance?
Well, you take out a policy, like let's say $1 million policy, that if they get sick or miss X amount of performances, there's all kinds of insurances.
Well, didn't you actually have, yes, you did. You had the belly dancers, navel insured, but that was for publicity.
We did that for publicity. It was very
That's
funny.
That's what Terry did. I thought it was very funny. Got in all the papers, too.
Is there any project you wish you'd said yes to that became a great success after you turned it down and someone else produced it?
Mm-hmm.
What one?
They came to us about Annie.
Did they? I didn't know that.
And go up to Long Wharf. And,
oh, yeah,
I mean, up to Goodspeed, and we didn't go.
It wasn't supposed to be very good.
I know. So. So I guess in hindsight, yes.
How wrong we were.
You know?
So how do you feel when something like that becomes a success? Maybe you know some people in it and are happy for
them.
I say
God bless them all. Uh-huh. There's plenty of success. There's a lot of success available for everyone.
Do you know what your next projects will be?
Yes.
Yeah.
Could you talk about them yet, or would you rather not?
Talk about them, Terry. Talk about them.
Well, which ones? I mean, some of them, the ink isn't dry on the contract, so we can't. We saw a wonderful play in London, which we both were crazy about, written by J.P. Dunleavy, who wrote The Ginger Man. This is a very sexy play.
Try to say the title. Oh, I hope he changes the title.
Beastly Beatitudes, Balthazar B.
Can you imagine going around and saying, what are you doing, the Beastly Beatitudes of Balthazar B? You go crazy. But the novel's sort of well known. And
is it romantic?
We should run a contest
comedy.
And people think of it. I don't know, maybe.
What's the future of Sugar Babies?
We hope it goes forever and ever and ever. And we hope to take it on.
If Mickey and Anne hold up, it could go forever and ever and ever.
Yes.
And if we hold up, too.
Somebody said, what are you going to give Mickey and Anne if you can get them to sign for, let's say, 5 more years? So I said, oh, I'm going to give them an oxygen tent and an ambulance and an attendant. So we hope it goes on forever.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Definitely
thank
enjoyed
you.
The show a lot, too. Thanks for being here. Harry Rigby and Terry Kramer are my guests. They're the co-producers of the burlesque musical Sugar Babies, which just opened again in Philadelphia at the Schubert Theater for a 4-week run. Will it be headed to Broadway at any point? Do you know if it'll be going back?
We've been asked to come back, you know.
So it's a question of whether...
After the tour, but I mean, that's a long time. Also, where's that place in Africa we've been asked to play?
Oh, you know where Sinatra did a concert? I think it's called
Sun
City.
Did one.
Zimbabwe or one of those places.
It's, I don't know, it's like the Vegas of East Africa.
Yeah.
So can you imagine the Vegas of East Africa? But anyway, we've been asked to go there for an enormous amount of money.
And we're looking forward,
hope,
maybe to go to Radio City.
Yeah.
We'd like to do that for a couple of weeks.
Good luck. And thanks
Thank
very much
you.
For being here.
Thank you.
It's 23 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air on 91 FM. Interval with Frances Davis is coming up in just a few minutes. This is Fanny Bryce, who used to perform in burlesque.
A wise guy is he laughs. He treats the girls rough. His hugs and kisses scare him. He don't spare him. You should see his Hebrew hair. He wants them all to tell him when he goes by. Rose Goldstein's husband, tell him them in the eye. Say he acts like a real Arabian lord. Since he bought a brand new second-hand port, don't speak. He's the cheek of Avenue B. They would like the girlies, but their chances to slip. If a fella gets a girlie, he only lasts a day. He walks by and winks his eye and takes her away. He's the chief of Avenue B. I'm telling you, he's the temp of them all. Boil his time, for him they would die. He gets a boil on Sunday, leaves her Monday. Some boils even don't last one day. He takes the boil to the swellest cabaret. But it's the woman who pays and pays and pays. The husbands, they are scared of their lives. Then they go to work, they lock up their wives. Don't speak, he's the chief of Avenue B.
Fanny Bryce singing The Sheik of Avenue B, and it's 20 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, 91 FM on the dial, and you're listening to Fresh Air.